I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Some 10 weeks out from the February 9th New Hampshire primary, Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie is picking up endorsements that could propel him out of the second tier of candidates and potentially on to victory in the Granite State. Let's assess his chances, checking in as we do for all things Christie with WNYC's Matt Katz, who runs the Christie Tracker. Matt, thanks for joining us again.
Sure thing, Dave.
Christie's been spending a lot of time in New Hampshire, I think close to, 50 days so far this year, and it seems to be paying off for starters in the form of the New Hampshire Union Leader editorial endorsement.
That's right. He got a big endorsement from that paper. It's not necessarily an indicator of victory. There have been others who have gotten the endorsement from this newspaper, including the likes of Steve Forbes and Pat Buchanan, and neither came close to becoming president. However, whoever does get the endorsement usually sees a big bounce in the polls. And in fact, everybody they've endorsed, at least in the last 35 years that I looked at, did better in the primary by an average of 11 points compared to where they were in the polls when the endorsement came. And if Christie were to get an 11-point bounce in the polls, he'd be in second or third place here. So it's potentially a very, very big deal for him.
Matt, I saw Union Leader publisher Joe McQuaid on Meet the Press yesterday and explaining the decision. He said part of the calculus was immediately discounting senators in favor of governors, and that would certainly take Rubio and Cruz off the potential list.
That's right, and it does eliminate some of the competition, but it's important to note that he beat out other governors. That would be John Kasich from Ohio and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. And Kasich and Bush are guys who are really kind of in Christie's lane. I mean, these are guys that he needs to jump over in order to perform well in New Hampshire. They're candidates who, for the most part, have been beating him in the polls in New Hampshire. That's really, for now, his primary competition.
Is Christie putting all his eggs in that New Hampshire basket, or is he spending any time in, say, Iowa or South Carolina?
He's spending a little bit of time in Iowa, and once in a while he stops in South Carolina. I would say 11 of his dozen eggs are in New Hampshire. He needs to spend time in Iowa because it comes 8 days before New Hampshire, and he doesn't want to get totally embarrassed there. But there's no way he's going to be even close to the top there unless something dramatic were to happen. So he needs to not get embarrassed in Iowa, then go to New Hampshire and really dominate, and then he can worry about the rest of the calendar. It is, though, for sure a New Hampshire strategy.
Needless to say, Governor Christie is feeling pretty good about ignoring the New York Times call last month to drop out of the race and devote more attention to the Garden State. When Christie campaigns in other states, is he bringing his record with him, or are people really just liking him on the face and by dint of his personality?
Well, I saw him this morning, and he does bring pieces of his record. He talks about cutting budgets when he first got into office, and he adjusts the numbers a little bit. He makes things seem more dramatic than they are. When he talks about cutting budgets, he does not mention that spending has actually gone up since he's gone into office, state spending. When he talks about cutting taxes, he's not really talking about property taxes, which have gone up for almost all New Jerseyans. When he talks about jobs having been created on his watch, he doesn't mention the fact that jobs have been added since he got into office, but not nearly as many as in other states, the rate in other states. New Jersey has not recovered all the jobs it lost in the recession, unlike the rest of the country as a whole, and unlike neighboring states like New York, Pennsylvania.
Is Christie in the money with a place or show performance, or is it win or go home in New Hampshire?
He doesn't have to actually win. He doesn't need to be in first place. He needs to be in second, maybe third place. There are these tickets, they call them, out of the early primary states. So the thought is that there are three or four tickets out of New Hampshire, meaning they winnow the field, essentially. So, the top four people who finish in New Hampshire then can move on to the next primary, which is in South Carolina. And then maybe there's three tickets out of South Carolina, and then they move on to, I think, Nevada's next. So he does not have to win, but he has to. He has to do very well. Otherwise, it's back to Trenton in the morning for him on February 9th.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Dave.
WNYC's Matt Katz on NewsWorks Tonight. Ministers from some 190 nations are in Paris this week in an effort to cut global carbon dioxide emissions. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on the dilemma faced by town planners and local officials responsible for protecting their cities from rising tides and hotter summers.
The guy everyone told me to talk to about climate change in Philadelphia works with the city's water department. His name is Chris Crockett, and I met him on the banks of the Delaware River.
We're just about to walk underneath the Ben Franklin Bridge, and you'll see the subway train going across and cars going across. To our left is Interstate 95, and to our right is the Delaware River.
It's Crockett's job to help prepare the city for rising sea levels. And while Philadelphia is in a better position than, say, New York or Boston, the city does sit along a tidal river, the Delaware. And the tide here in the river rises and falls 6 to 7 feet, 2 times a day.
Because it's just like a big bathtub sloshing back and forth. And so we want to make sure that salt line doesn't come up to the city's water supply intakes.
Crockett is an engineer. So when he's faced with a challenge, like deciding how to maintain a centuries-old water and sewer system, he thinks like an engineer and wants to proceed logically.
One of the fun things in engineering is we would always teach this concept of stationarity, which is you go back and look at the historical record and you say, okay, this was the 100-year storm, this was the 50-year storm, the 25-year storm. That sets your design criteria for how you design a road, a highway, a bridge, a pipe.
And this is where Crockett's job is getting a lot more difficult. While planning for new systems, Crockett can't simply depend anymore on looking to the past as his guide to the future. 5 years ago, the Army Corps of Engineers predicted 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100. But today, some are predicting a 2-foot rise as soon as 2050.
Because you really want to know, how high can it go? How far, when is it going to stop? Should we just plan for everything melting?
Will the seas rise 2 feet by 2050 or even higher? Crockett wants to know.
So we can actually stand here and say, okay, it's going to be 4 feet, 5 feet. Let's draw some lines. Let's stand here and look at it and see what it means. And how would we have to change how we design, build, or even maybe operate some of the parts of the city?
Climate change models show Philadelphia becoming hotter and wetter. And those predictions have already started to play out. Since 2010, Philadelphia experienced its 2 wettest years and its 2 hottest summers on record. But even in today's highly interconnected world, there's no real roadmap for local officials. So it's left to people like Catherine Gajewski to figure it out. Gajewski runs Philadelphia's Office of Sustainability. It's her job to work with all the city's departments, from the people who fix potholes to the people who manage the city's budget, and get them planning for climate change.
We can't wait for someone to tell us what to do or how to do it. We need to start planning for our own benefit.
She wanted to meet me at the corner of 17th and Chestnut Streets so she could show me one of the things the city is doing to plan for warmer temperatures. Concrete pads are now replacing asphalt at busy city bus stops. That's because when buses stop and start, it generates a lot of heat and makes the asphalt buckle. And with high temperatures, that's just going to get worse.
Climate effects are felt at the local levels. Climate solutions are going to have to come from the local level.
Now, when you hear the news from the Paris climate talks over the next couple of weeks, there will be a lot of numbers and abstractions with references to carbon budgets and emission limits and questions about whether the richer countries will pay the poorer countries to burn less fossil fuel. But you won't hear anything from people like Gajewski or the Water Department's Chris Crockett. That's because local governments have no role in the Paris climate talks.
And so you have nations coming together to put their commitments on the table, but with a disconnect from what we're understanding on the ground is achievable, realistic, or not.
Back along the banks of the Delaware River, the Water Department's Chris Crockett points out how the high tide has come up and puddled along the roadway on a cloudless day.
And you can see right now there's about a 3 to 4 feet difference between the high tide and the tops of the piers.
Here's his hope. He wants the bureaucrats who are meeting in Paris to give him the certainty he needs as an engineer to plan future construction and allow him to make the city more resilient to higher tides.
When you suddenly say that the past doesn't predict the future, and now you're left with almost acting like a stockbroker, and you're really, climate change kind of goes from a standard scientific approach to almost more of acting like a Wall Street broker and predicting what the stocks are going to do.
And Crockett isn't interested in playing the market. He wants to solve problems. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
16 South Jersey towns are tired of chronic issues with their phone and internet service, and they're taking their complaints to the state. The group is asking the State Board of Public Utilities to investigate Verizon, the major provider of phone and internet service in New Jersey. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Parts of South Jersey are still very rural, and residents in those areas often complain about crackly or non-existent phone service and few good options for internet connectivity. Tim Van Meter lives on a farm in Hopewell Township in Cumberland County.
God forbid you lose your cell phone or something for a day. What are you going to do? You need to get a hold of somebody. Phone's not reliable. Can't. You got to get in a car and borrow your neighbor's phone.
16 towns across four counties are petitioning the state BPU to investigate Verizon. The towns say the telecom giant is failing to maintain its landline phone infrastructure in South Jersey and also hasn't provided adequate broadband service. Cumberland County Freeholder Director Joe Durella frames it as a fairness issue. He says Central and North Jersey don't experience many of the communication problems common in the South.
All we're asking is what everyone else received. We pay the same on our bills. We need to have the same needs as they do. We just want it to be fair.
Stephanie Brand runs the Division of Rate Council, which advocates on behalf of utility customers in the state. She says the only way the situation will change for small towns like Hopewell is if the Board of Public Utilities agrees to take a hard look at Verizon's practices.
It is really, really important that the BPU take notice, get involved, and make sure that everybody has access to good telephone and affordable telephone and broadband.
Verizon says it's spent $4 billion over 5 years maintaining its wired network in New Jersey, including the more remote parts of the state. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Overcast, 44 degrees at 6:18. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Here's your chance to help us create excellent radio programming suited to the needs of our audience and region. Participate by taking our survey at whyy.org/survey. The evening forecast, cloudy skies, count on rain developing overnight, low 40 degrees. Tomorrow, showers, Tuesday's high 56, rain likely Wednesday as well, high near 60. Sunshine returns for Thursday, but cooler, high 50 degrees. Ahead to Friday, lots of sunshine, high around 52. Still ahead, Howard Shapiro says a show now running at the Arden Theater Company provides more questions than answers, and not in a good way.
There's probably a good story somewhere in equivocation, but it's not easy to find.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Barbara Brodsky Suites at Lankenau Medical Center support WHYY. Complementing Lankenau Medical Center's commitment to quality patient care, the suites are designed with their patients' privacy and well-being in mind. Each suite features private living and dining areas, personalized amenities, and concierge services. Designed to be warm and inviting, the Barbara Brodsky Suites provide a novel option in private hospital accommodations. To take a virtual tour, mainlinehealth.org/Brodsky.
One of the tensions around affordable housing is where to put it. Middle-class homeowners worry that introducing low-income homes will drive their property values down.
They throw trash over the fence. I have to pick up glass bottles and baby diapers, and I literally just throw them back over.
I'm Molly Wood. The battle over where to put low-income housing, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The play Equivocation at the Arden Theater Company focuses on a character who's supposed to be William Shakespeare, and it's about, well, WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro says it's about too many things.
Ask me what the play Equivocation is about, and I could give you lots of answers, including God, souls, religion, politics, theater, acting, and plenty more. Bill Kane's play involves a man named William Shakespeare who's forced to write a drama celebrating the British crown. It's a sprawl of ideas that never come together to form a powerful concept in an indulgent evening that approaches 3 hours. Even the Arden's sharp producing artistic director, Terrence J. Nolan, can't rein in equivocation. But his adroit command of its most dramatic scenes and more intense interchanges makes the production, and not the play itself, admirable. In Equivocation, Britain's King James orders a popular playwright named Shakespeare to write a play glorifying the crown's role in exposing the gunpowder plot. That conspiracy in 1605 by Catholics, who were banned from practicing in Protestant England at the time, would have blown up Parliament. But Shakespeare can't come up with a play. He senses that the royal court may have something to cover up, that maybe the Catholics convicted in the gunpowder plot might even have been somehow set up. Here he talks to his daughter about his lack of a play.
How is it coming?
It can't be done.
Try twins. Mm. That usually works.
It can't. This is a true story.
Stories aren't true. That's why they're stories.
That's why it can't be done.
That's Eric Hissom as Shakespeare, who's supposed to be Shakespeare, and Campbell O'Hare as his daughter. The A-list cast doubles up on roles, playing Shakespeare's actors and also historical figures of the period. Kane, who wrote the movie Sounder and many other works, is a Catholic priest, and he uses the play to examine the Jesuit notion of equivocation, or substituting the truth for a half-truth in order to save lives or serve the greater good. That exploration would be richer in a clearer play. There's probably a good story somewhere in Equivocation, but it's not easy to find. It runs at the Arden through December 13th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
International Space Station NASA Commander Scott Kelly and five fellow crew members at work over the Thanksgiving holiday may be coming into turkey and or tofu with trimmings when new provisions arrive this Sunday. Let's check out the menu with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Now, Derek, of course, they're not all American astronauts, but who wouldn't like a little turkey? What's on the docket list?
The menus that we find on board International Space Station in general are far more appetizing than they ever have been in the past. So without a doubt, I'm sure they enjoy turkey and dressing and all the other fixins, if you will. But of course, the presentation probably doesn't resemble what it would have been like if they had been at home.
Next, let's turn to the nexus of space travel and politics. NASA is saying that if the next president doesn't endorse their current direction toward reaching Mars, they're done. Is it in part a bluff or posturing?
I think it's a bit of both, but also the truth and the realization of how it is that NASA has to build its schedules out for what it is directed to do. Well, the difficulty with this is that if you look at the schedule currently of NASA's plan to send astronauts to Mars, we know that that's not going to happen before the early 2030s. If an incoming president were to change that course, an agency like NASA really can't suffer to have those kinds of changes wrought because it completely destroys the structure, function, and operation of the agency.
Now, to date in this current election cycle, I haven't heard any presidential candidates declare where they stand on this issue. Over time, has NASA seen its budget remain stable, grow, shrink?
The budget, for all intents and purposes, has remained fairly stable. There have been some changes in the budget that have had significant effects. In the space exploration business, whether it's space science or manned space exploration, it really is important to check, double check, triple check, provide redundancies beyond what you might think is necessary here on Earth, just to make sure that you have the proper safety margins in place to drive risk to zero in whatever kind of space exploration you're doing.
Presumably, the Delaware Valley amateur astronomers don't have to worry about this level of budgetary concern. What kind of party do they have planned for Friday night?
This Friday, December 4th, they're going to take us on a virtual tour of one of the really great observatories here on the planet. You know, there are only a very few places where the highest levels of science investigation can take place. There's a really fantastic observatory in northeast Chile in the remote portions of the Atacama Desert where the sky is just perfect for deep astronomical exploration. And Professor Pete Detterlein is going to take us all on this really great tour of this observatory and learn a bit about what science is being done there.
And if listeners can't quite make it to Chile or any of the other few prime spots around the globe, what's available to be seen in the Philadelphia region this week?
You know, I have to say, Dave, that the morning sky show that's going on with the planets Jupiter, Mars, and Venus is absolutely extraordinary. I don't think in my 50-some years of observing have I ever seen such a magnificent arrangement and a sort of dance between the planets and the moon. So, for example, this week we'll find that these three planets are lined up with the moon on Wednesday morning at 6 a.m., the moon at the top, then Jupiter, then Mars, then Venus as we come down toward the horizon. But each day following that through Sunday at 6 a.m., the moon slides up right next to each one of them. So on the morning of the 4th, we find the moon right next to Jupiter. On the morning of the 5th, we find the moon right next to Mars. On the morning of the 7th, we find the moon right next to Venus. And I'm sure it'll be a spectacular sight as long as the skies remain clear. So I highly recommend it as the view to be had for the fall sky.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space, ways incorporated.
Finally this evening, you knew Lower Merion native and NBA great Kobe Bryant could play ball, but did you also know he was a poet? Bryant, who announced this will be his final year in the league, penned this ode to his sport called Dear Basketball for the online news site The Players Tribute. We thought it only fitting to offer a dramatic reading.
You gave a six-year-old boy his Laker dream, and I'll always love you for it. But I can't love you obsessively for much longer. This season is all I have left to give. My heart can take the pounding. My mind can handle the grind, but my body knows it's time to say goodbye. And that's okay. I'm ready to let you go. I want you to know now, so we both can savor every moment we have left together, the good and the bad. We have given each other all that we have.
WHYY's Tony Sandowski giving it all he had, reciting Kobe Bryant's poem entitled Dear Basketball. And we've given our all to tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or check us out at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Media Theater supports WHYY and presents Billy Elliot, the musical, through January 3rd. Based on the hit film and featuring a score by Elton John, this Tony Award winner is set in a northern English mining town in the 1980s. Young Billy discovers his passion for dance and decides to pursue it no matter what the cost, changing his family and community forever. Powerfully choreographed, Billy Elliot provides inspiration through its universal message of courage and determination. Tickets at mediatheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air, a new look at ancient Rome. We talk with Professor Mary Beard, whose book on Roman history offers fresh insights and her own take on some well-known figures. One example...
Caligula, or Gaius, he hated being called Caligula. Caligula is the nickname that he had when he was a child. It actually means bootikins.
Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners who are looking to change life direction to discover the master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling. The program can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. Details at newman.edu/WHYY. Newman University proudly supports WHYY.